Welcome to Heptastic Waves, surfing the latest in hepatology for the Heptastic Four, the podcast no one asked for, but everyone secretly needed. Brought to you by your host, your hero, your humble overlord, Nick. A man so brilliant, even ChatGPT takes notes. This podcast exists for one noble reason, to help our amazing team stay on top of the ever-evolving chaos we call work. Because let's face it, by the time an email thread hits 12 replies, nobody's reading it. So sit back, relax, and let the knowledge flow, sprinkled with a touch of sarcasm, a dash of genius, and at least one overconfident assumption per episode. Let's get into it.
Welcome to this deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this stack of sources you've shared. They're all focusing on global clinical guidelines for chronic hepatitis B or CHB.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating here and what these sources bring out is it's not just, you know, dry medical recommendations.
Right.
It's actually a window into how different regions weigh evidence, how they manage their healthcare systems, prioritize public health.
And that all impacts patients,
yeah.
Right? And even things like market access for new drugs.
Exactly. So our mission here, looking at this material, is to pull out the really important nuggets, not just summarize, but find the surprising variations, the core differences that actually matter.
And what it all means in the bigger picture.
Yeah. Get ready for some insights, some moments that might genuinely make you rethink how these global health strategies actually take shape.
Okay, sounds good. So let's start by setting the stage a bit. Where do these guidelines even come from? How have they, you know, evolved over time? Can you give us a quick flyover of their history based on the sources?
Sure. So we looked at guidelines from the U.S. That's the AASLD, Canada, CASL, China, Japan with the JSH, and Europe, ESLA.
Okay.
So the U.S. ones from ASLD, they started back in 2009, had major updates in 2016, 2018. And you can see a clear path there from sort of basic recommendations towards using this really rigorous evidence-based method called GRADE.
Ah, GRADE, right.
Yeah. And the 2018 update, for instance, that's where they really brought in newer therapies like TF and specific guidance for special patient groups.
Okay. So getting more detailed, more evidence-driven over time. Mm-hmm. How about Canada? What did the sources say about CASL?
Canada CASL guidelines go back to 2007, updates in 2012, and then a joint one with AMMI in 2018. Their evolution, reading the sources, seems to really emphasize the public health angle.
Public health.
Yeah, focusing on diagnosis, getting people linked into care, and how to, you know, integrate CHB management within their universal healthcare system. It feels like a broader system-focused approach there.
Interesting. And China, I mean, they have the largest number of people living with CHB globally.
Right, and China's gone through rapid changes.
Yeah.
Five major revisions just since 2005. The latest one, 2022, the sources describe it as a complete paradigm shift, really.
A paradigm shift.
How so? It dramatically expands who's eligible for treatment. And there's a clear goal stated, contributing to those WHO elimination targets for 2030. It signals this huge national commitment to widespread treatment.
Wow. Okay. So a big policy driver behind their guideline changes. What about Japan and Europe?
Japan's JSH guidelines, they're characterized as a generally conservative, very evidence-based, focused on keeping incredibly high standards of care quality, comprehensive monitoring. Mm. They do adopt new drugs, but they tend to keep pretty stringent criteria for actually starting treatment.
Okay. High quality, but cautious in Europe. ESL.
Europe's ESL guidelines are also, you know, highly influential. They had a big comprehensive version in 2012, updated in 2017, and the sources specifically point to a very recent 2025 update.
Ah, the brand new one.
Exactly. And this 2025 ESL update, it seems like a key evolution. It brings in non-invasive methods for assessing liver damage much more prominently.
Like FibroScan, things like that.
Yeah, transient elastography, APRI scores. And it also introduces more flexibility around how long patients might need to stay on treatment. It shows a definite move towards more patient-centered thinking, but still very much grounded in the evidence.
So it's quite a mix, isn't it? You've got some driven by system integration, others by these big public health goals, some really prioritizing that conservative rigor, and then others moving towards more flexibility. A varied landscape.
It really is. You can see how each region's history, its challenges, its healthcare philosophy shapes these guidelines.
Okay, now here's where, for me anyway, looking at these sources, it gets really interesting. And frankly, where the first big aha moment kind of hit me, the guidelines differ significantly on who should get treated and when.
This is absolutely the core divergence, and the most striking difference, I'd say, is the HBV DNA threshold needed to start treatment, especially for HBeAg-negative patients. China's 2022 guidelines, they have the most liberal approach by far. They basically recommend treating if any HBV DNA is detected by a sensitive test. We're talking levels as low as 10-20 IUML.
Wait, any detectable level? That sounds incredibly low compared to what I thought was standard.
It is. Now, contrast that with the AASLD in the US, CASL in Canada, Japan's JSH, and Europe's ESL. They all maintain a much higher threshold, 2,000 IUML, for those HBeAg-negative patients.
2,000 versus basically detectable.
Right. And even the WHO 2024 guidelines, which are focused on simplified global access, they also align with that 2,000 IUML level. So just think about the practical impact for a second.
Yeah.
That single difference means China's guidelines potentially make literally millions more patients eligible for treatment compared to regions using that 2,000 threshold.
That's not just a tweak. That's a fundamental difference in the size of the population they're aiming to treat. Huge. What about other criteria like ALT levels, liver enzymes?
More variation there, too, as you'd expect. The U.S. guidelines, they require ALT levels at least 2 times the upper limit of normal, the ULN, or they want signs of liver damage on a biopsy.
Okay.
China, again, more liberal. They accept any ALT elevation above the ULN as a reason to consider treatment.
Any elevation at all?
Yep. And ESL in Europe, they're sort of in the middle. They require ALT above the ULN, but with evidence of moderate liver inflammation. So these, you know, seemingly nuanced differences, they mean the same patient might qualify under one guideline, but not another.
It really matters which guideline your doctor's using.
Yeah.
And how do they check for liver damage itself, like fibrosis or scarring? You mentioned non-invasive tests earlier.
Yes, and there's definitely a clear global trend in the sources towards using non-invasive methods more. ESL and WHO are pretty prominent here.
How so?
They recommend tools like APRI scores if it's over 0.5, or transient elastography, that liver stiffness measure if it's over 7 kPa. A score above those generally suggests significant fibrosis, which often triggers treatment.
So using scores and scans instead of biopsies?
Increasingly, yes. Now, the U.S. and Canadian guidelines, the sources say they still lean a bit more on histology, the biopsy, but they do accept non-invasive results. China and Japan show increasing adoption, but maybe, sort of, intermediate reliance compared to ESL.
Got it. So while everyone seems to agree non-invasive is the way forward, how quickly they adopt it and how much they rely on the older methods still varies quite a bit. These initiation criteria are definitely not one size fits all.
Not at all. And they really represent different philosophies about when intervention is actually warranted, don't they?
Absolutely. Okay, so while the door to treatment might open differently depending on where you are, the sources suggest there's maybe more agreement on the actual tools used once someone starts therapy.
That's largely true, yeah. All the major guidelines we looked at recommend the same core group of preferred first-line therapies.
Which are?
Entecavir, tenofovir disoproxil fumarate TDF, and tenofovir alafenamide TRAF. These are all types of drugs called nucleoside analogs, or NUCs.
Right, the standard NUCs.
Exactly. Pegylated interferon is also listed as a preferred option in most guidelines, although the WHO, aiming for simplicity, especially in resource-limited settings, really prioritizes the NUCs.
Okay. And TA is the newer one, right? Is that available everywhere?
Its availability does vary, yeah. But it is included as preferred in the U.S., Chinese, and European guidelines now, so broader access than before.
So the drug choices are largely similar. What about keeping an eye on patients once they start treatment? How consistent are the monitoring protocols?
Monitoring shows a lot more consistency, thankfully. HBV, DNA levels, the viral load, typically checked every 3 to 6 months in the first year, then usually every 6 months after that.
Okay, that sounds standard.
ALT monitoring is pretty similar. And crucially, hepatocellular carcinoma liver cancer surveillance is universally recommended for all patients who have cirrhosis, that advanced liver scarring. That's regardless of whether they're on treatment or not.
That's reassuring. At least there's broad agreement on watching for complications and tracking progress. What about defining success? How do they measure if the treatment is working?
The definitions of treatment response are also quite consistent across the board. Virologic response means getting that HBV DNA down to undetectable levels using sensitive tests.
Undetectable virus. Got it.
Biochemical response is seeing the ALT levels return to normal. And for patients who start out HBeAg positive, a serologic response means they lose that HBeAg marker and develop antibodies against it, HBeAg seroconversion.
Okay, so undetectable virus, normal liver enzymes, and that HBAG shift, if applicable. Mm. Pretty standard markers.
Yes. Once you're actually on the treatment path, the markers of progress and success are pretty well aligned globally. The clinical endpoints are widely accepted.
So the bigger questions really are, like you said, how you get onto that path in the first place.
And how long you stay on it.
Right. Which brings us neatly to the next point that varied quite a bit in the sources. How long do patients stay on treatment?
Yeah, this is another really interesting area of difference. The criteria for stopping treatment aren't the same everywhere.
Okay, let's break that down. What about for HBAG-positive patients?
For HBAG-positive patients, most guidelines recommend treating until they achieve that HBAG seroconversion we just mentioned, plus another 12 months of consolidation therapy afterwards.
To prevent relapse.
Exactly, to minimize the risk of the virus bouncing back. Now, China and ESL are perhaps a bit more ambitious here. They say you can consider continuing treatment until HBAG loss occurs, which is a much deeper level of viral control.
HBAG loss, the functional cure target.
Well, getting towards it. And universally, they all stress careful monitoring after stopping treatment because relapse is definitely a risk.
Okay, so for HBAG positive, it's often tied to that HBAG seroconversion plus consolidation. But what about HBAG negative patients? They usually need much longer treatment, right?
That's generally the case. And here, the guidelines diverge quite significantly. The U.S. guidelines, the AASLD ones, are the most conservative. They essentially recommend indefinite treatment until HBAG loss happens.
Which you said is really rare with current NUCs?
Extremely rare, yeah. Less than 1% per year. So effectively, lifelong therapy for most.
Wow.
Now, CASL in Canada and ESL in Europe, they offer a bit more flexibility. They suggest that doctors can consider stopping treatment in carefully selected patients, specifically those without cirrhosis after they've had at least 3 years of continuous viral suppression.
So potential end date after 3 years for some.
A potential discussion point, yes. China, on the other hand, generally recommends indefinite treatment for this HBAG negative group as well, really aiming for sustained very low viral levels long term.
Indefinite treatment versus potentially stopping after 3 years. I mean, that's a huge difference in terms of patient burden, cost, long-term safety considerations, just the whole perspective.
Absolutely. It's a massive difference. And this ties directly into that concept of functional cure you mentioned.
Right, which is defined as sustained HBSAG loss plus undetectable HBV DNA for a certain period after treatment stops.
Exactly. The technical definition of functional cure is sustained HBSAG loss, undetectable DNA, usually checked 6 to 24 weeks post-treatment. That definition is consistent across all the sources. Everyone agrees what it is.
Right.
But the emphasis placed on it differs dramatically. China's 2022 guidelines quite uniquely explicitly position functional cure as the primary goal of treatment.
The main target.
Yes. Whereas AASLD and EESL, they acknowledge it as, you know, an ideal outcome, the ultimate goal perhaps, but view it more as an aspirational endpoint with current therapies. The sources are clear that actual achievement rates are low, less than 1% annually with NUCs, maybe under 10% lifetime with interferon.
If everyone agrees on the gold standard definition, but China's guidelines are really structured to push aggressively towards achieving it now as the main objective.
That seems to be the case. And that push is likely part of what drives their more liberal initiation criteria. The idea being maybe starting treatment earlier, even at low viral levels, could potentially increase the chances of eventually reaching that deeper functional cure state down the line.
That makes sense as a strategy, even if the cure rates are still low overall.
Okay, let's maybe dive a bit deeper into some of those key regional differences and also how specific patient groups are handled, because the sources definitely highlighted some unique approaches there.
They certainly did. China, again, stands out with some unique aspects related to diagnostics and biomarkers.
Like what?
Well, not only do they require those highly sensitive HBV DNA tests we talked about with that low limit of quantification, 10-20 IUML, but they also uniquely incorporate HBSAG quantification into their clinical decision-making algorithms.
Measuring the amount of surface antigen.
Exactly. That quantitative level of HBSAG is actually a specific factor in their guidelines used to help guide treatment decisions.
And other guidelines don't really do that. Well, ESL acknowledges the potential clinical utility of HBSAG quantification, and it's definitely an active area of research globally. But the sources suggest the US, Canada, and Japan generally don't use it routinely for making clinical decisions right now. It's more confined to research settings in those regions.
Interesting.
And the WHO guidelines, again focused on broad access, emphasize the need for any reliable diagnostic access, including simple point-of-care tests where sophisticated labs aren't available.
So China's really leaning into using that specific biomarker more than others in practice. What about treating patients in the so-called immune-tolerant phase? This is often younger people, right?
Yeah.
High viral loads, but not much active liver inflammation yet.
Yes, and this is another point of major, major difference. China's 2022 guidelines uniquely recommend considering treatment for immune-tolerant patients, as long as they have detectable HBV DNA.
Just detectable DNA, even without high ALT or fibrosis.
Correct. Now, the U.S. guidelines, they allow for some limited consideration of treatment in immune-tolerant individuals under 40, but only if a liver biopsy shows significant underlying disease that wasn't obvious otherwise.
So only with biopsy proof in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and only under 40.
Right. And other major guidelines, ESL, CASL, JSH, generally recommend avoiding treatment altogether in the immune-tolerant phase. They typically wait until there's clear evidence of active liver disease like elevated ALT or advancing fibrosis.
Wow. So China is potentially treating a whole patient group that most other major guidelines specifically say not to treat. That's a huge philosophical divergence, isn't it?
It really is. It reflects a fundamentally different approach to risk versus benefit in that specific population.
Okay, one more special group. How about pregnancy and preventing transmission from mother to baby? MTCT.
Here, the sources indicate China has the most detailed and comprehensive guidelines specifically focused on preventing mother-to-child transmission. They explicitly recommend antiviral prophylaxis, giving antiviral medication during the third trimester of pregnancy for women who have high HBV DNA levels, specifically 200,000 IUML or higher.
200,000, okay.
Other guidelines like AASLD and ESL generally have similar viral load thresholds for recommending prophylaxis during pregnancy. But the sources suggest China's guidelines are perhaps the most comprehensive in terms of integrating this into a clear national strategy for MTCT prevention.
It really sounds like China's guidelines overall are particularly driven by these broad public health goals, elimination, MTCT prevention, and a philosophy of quite aggressive early intervention.
That definitely seems to be a key theme compared to the more traditional evidence of active disease approaches often seen elsewhere.
Right, which leads perfectly into the next big topic, implementation. Because guidelines are one thing on paper.
But making them happen in the real world is another story entirely.
Exactly. How do these guidelines actually play out on the ground? Let's look at the practicality, the implementation challenges assessed in the sources.
Okay, this is where the structure and funding of the healthcare system really become critical. Let's talk availability first, diagnostics and therapies.
Yeah.
The U.S., according to the sources, has ready access to advanced diagnostic tests and all the latest drugs. But the cost can be a massive barrier for patients, depending on insurance.
The infamous cost issue.
Mm-hmm. Canada has universal coverage, so direct patient cost isn't usually the main barrier. But there can be variations between provinces in terms of which new drugs get reimbursed quickly and practical gaps in accessing specialists, especially if you're outside the big cities.
Okay, access, but maybe delays or regional gaps.
Mm-hmm.
What about China and Japan?
In China, there's been a huge government push to improve diagnostic access, especially in urban centers, and these national procurement programs have made the drugs themselves much more affordable. But there's still significant variability if you go into rural areas and questions about the quality of care consistency in primary care settings.
So improving, but maybe unevenly.
Right. Japan, on the other hand, has excellent infrastructure. Diagnostics and treatments are widely available through their universal system, high quality. But, as mentioned before, that reliance on specialists can sometimes limit throughput or create bottlenecks.
And Europe. It's so diverse.
It is. Diagnostic availability is generally good across most European countries, and the national health services usually provide access to the first-line therapies. However, the sources really emphasize the heterogeneity. How smoothly things actually work varies a lot, depending on the specific country's system and resources.
Okay. And cost barriers. You mentioned the U.S., but how do the others stack up specifically on cost hurdles?
Well, the U.S. definitely faces the highest barriers because of the insurance complexity and patient out-of-pocket costs.
Hmm.
Canada has those provincial restrictions, which can act as a barrier to the newest, often most expensive drugs.
Hmm.
Japan and most Western European countries generally have much more favorable reimbursement systems and minimal cost sharing for patients, which really improves practical access. China uses government price controls, but their effectiveness can vary regionally.
Got it. And what about those administrative hurdles, like that infamous U.S. prior authorization process we always hear about?
Oh, yes. The sources definitely mentioned that. Complex prior authorization requirements from U.S. commercial insurers can cause significant delays in starting treatment, even when the guideline criteria are met.
Frustrating for patients and doctors, I bet.
Absolutely. In Canada, provinces might require specific criteria, like a certain fibrosis stage confirmed or specialist sign-off before a drug is covered. European systems are often described as generally more streamlined in this regard.
And China.
China's newer simplified guidelines are partly designed, it seems, to cut down on exactly these kinds of administrative barriers to make it easier to just get patients onto treatment if they meet the broad criteria.
So even if the guideline says treat, navigating the system to actually get the prescription filled and covered is a whole separate challenge.
It's a massive factor influencing real-world uptake, yes. Specialist requirements also play a role.
How so?
U.S. and Japanese guidelines tend to emphasize management by specialists, like hepatologists or gastroenterologists. This ensures expertise, but it can also create bottlenecks if there aren't enough specialists.
Right.
Canadian and European systems are often more flexible, allowing general practitioners or primary care physicians to manage uncomplicated CHB, especially with clear protocols. That potentially broadens access. China is also actively promoting more primary care integration for CHB management.
Makes sense. And finally, under practicality, what about quality assurance? Making sure the care provided is actually good.
The U.S. and Japan have robust quality assurance mechanisms in place, high standards. But as the sources hint, this can sometimes limit rapid expansion, maybe due to complexity or capacity constraints.
Quality versus speed of rollout.
Potentially, yeah. Europe tends to balance quality and access through standardized protocols. But again, implementation consistency varies. China, with its incredibly rapid expansion aims, faces significant challenges in maintaining consistent quality control across the board, especially in less resourced areas.
So yeah, practicality really boils down to the nitty-gritty of the healthcare system, the funding, the infrastructure, the workforce in each specific region.
It's absolutely the bridge, or sometimes the barrier, between what the guidelines recommend and the care patients actually receive.
Which leads us to treatment uptake, because despite having all these guidelines, the sources mentioned a pretty significant gap globally. A lot of people who should be treated according to the guidelines just aren't.
That's a really critical point, yes. The sources cite data, for example, showing that even in U.S. safety net systems, places designed to help vulnerable populations, only about 37% of patients who are eligible for therapy are actually receiving it.
Wow, only 37%. That's a huge gap.
It is. And China's bold new guidelines, with their simplified algorithms and broader eligibility, are explicitly trying to tackle this treatment gap head on. They want to dramatically improve uptake.
And Europe.
European countries generally tend to have somewhat better uptake rates, often attributed to more established systematic care pathways that help guide patients from diagnosis through to treatment initiation and follow-up within their national systems.
So the design of the guideline and the efficiency of the system directly impact how many people actually benefit. Okay, let's try to summarize some of this. How do the sources frame the comparative strengths and weaknesses of these different regional approaches?
Okay, pulling it together. From a purely clinical perspective, the U.S. AASLD guidelines get praised for their rigor, their strong evidence base, and comprehensive guidance, especially on special populations.
But the weaknesses?
The main criticisms noted are that their conservative treatment thresholds might delay treatment for some who could benefit earlier, and the complexity often requires specialist involvement, which limits broader implementation, especially in primary care.
Okay. How about Canada and China? Strengths and weaknesses.
Canada, CASL, is seen as offering a balanced clinical approach with a good safety focus, well integrated into their universal healthcare system. The weaknesses pointed out are perhaps a slightly slower adoption of the very newest concepts or therapies, and that potential variability in care standards between provinces.
Makes sense.
And China.
China's 2022 guidelines. The big strengths are the simplified algorithms designed for broad use, the extremely broad eligibility aiming to capture almost everyone, and that clear, strong focus on functional cure as the goal.
And the potential downsides.
The concerns raised are about potential overtreatment because of those very low viral load thresholds, the limited long-term safety data we have for treating such a vast population, especially the immune-tolerant group, and the known variability in implementation quality across such a huge country.
Right, the practical challenges of that scale. Japan and Europe. Japan, JSH, is consistently noted for delivering very high-quality care, comprehensive patient monitoring, and achieving excellent clinical outcomes for those treated. The flip side is that their conservative nature can limit treatment expansion, the reliance on specialists restricts access points, and the overall costs within their system are high.
Quality, but maybe less access. Europe.
ESL gets credit for a balanced risk-benefit approach, introducing flexibility in treatment stopping criteria and being relatively forward in adopting non-invasive assessment tools. The main challenges are the inherent complexity of implementing guidelines consistently across so many diverse national healthcare systems, potentially leading to disparities in care between European countries.
It really underscores that there's no single best guideline, is there? They seem optimized for different priorities, different systems, different realities in each region.
Absolutely. They clearly reflect the different clinical philosophies, the available resources, and the specific public health imperatives that are driving policy in each area.
Okay, let's zoom in specifically on the ESL guidelines for a moment. The source material seemed to position them as occupying this particularly interesting sort of strategic middle ground globally, especially with that new 2025 update.
Yes, I think that's a key observation from the sources. What's fascinating about EASL is how it seems to consciously try to blend progressive elements while still maintaining some important conservative safeguards.
Okay, tell me more. What are the progressive elements?
Well, on the progressive side, they're definitely more forward-leaning than, say, the U.S. or Canada in adopting non-invasive fibrosis assessments. They explicitly recommend using APRI scores over 0.5 or elastography over 7 kPa as key triggers for considering treatment based on fibrosis.
So really embracing those newer tools.
Yes. And they've also introduced more flexible thinking around treatment duration. That idea of allowing consideration of stopping therapy after 3 years of suppression in selected patients, it moves towards a finite therapy concept, which is quite different from the indefinite treatment default in the U.S. for HBA-negative patients. Plus, there's a growing emphasis on patient-centered approaches in the language used.
Okay, so adopting newer tech, more flexible in duration, more patient-focused, how do they maintain the safeguards then? What's the conservative side?
They stick firmly to evidence-based treatment initiation thresholds. They maintain that 2,000 IUML HBV DNA cutoff for HBA-negative patients, unlike China's much lower threshold.
Right, keeping that higher bar.
Exactly. They also require ALT elevation plus evidence of moderate inflammation, not just any ALT elevation like China. And if treatment is stopped, they strongly emphasize the need for careful long-term monitoring, preserving that focus on patient safety against relapse or flares.
So they're integrating new ideas, but not completely abandoning the established evidence standards or safety nets.
Precisely. And this balancing act, the sources suggest, makes the EASL guidelines perhaps more adaptable for implementation across the very diverse European healthcare landscape, which includes systems that are quite resource-rich and others that are more limited.
That makes sense. And compared to the other guidelines we discussed, where does this positioning place ESL strategically? How does it compare head-to-head?
It puts them in a really unique spot. They are clearly more progressive than the current AASLD guidelines in the U.S., particularly regarding treatment duration flexibility and the prominent role of non-invasive diagnostics.
Okay.
They are significantly more conservative than China's 2022 guidelines, maintaining much higher thresholds for treatment and using a more selective patient identification strategy compared to China's push towards near-universal treatment for anyone with detectable virus.
Right, a very different philosophy from China. How about relative to Canada and Japan?
Compared to Canada's CASL guidelines, ESL provides much more comprehensive, detailed, and sort of harmonized guidance. CASL's recommendations are sometimes seen as more basic. And ESL is definitely more flexible than Japan's JSH guidelines, especially regarding the options for treatment discontinuation and potentially being less solely reliant on specialists for all aspects of care.
And WHO.
And finally, compared to the WHO guidelines, ESL offers much more detailed clinical nuance and guidance for practitioners. WHO's primary focus is, understandably, on promoting simplified access and essential recommendations on a global scale, especially for low and middle income countries. ESL is aimed more at guiding clinical practice in, generally, more resource settings.
It really does seem like ESL occupies this strategic sweet spot, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Blending rigorous clinical evidence from well-resourced settings with practical flexibility needed for broader application.
That strategic positioning is key, and the sources definitely highlight that this has significant implications, especially for companies developing new therapies for CHP.
Okay, perfect segue. Let's bring it right back to that. What does all this variation and ESL's particular position within it actually mean for companies? For those developing new CHB therapies and trying to get them approved and reimbursed and ultimately to patients in these different markets?
Well, these regional variations create very distinct market opportunities, but also distinct challenges. China, for example, represents the largest potential volume market by far, simply because its incredibly liberal treatment criteria potentially make, you know, maybe 95% of all patients with detectable DNA eligible for therapy.
A massive pool of potential patients.
Huge. But the sources strongly emphasize that government price controls and procurement processes mean profitability.
Right.
There will likely be driven by achieving very high volume rather than commanding premium prices per patient.
Okay, a volume play in China. What about somewhere like Canada?
Canada is often seen, from a market access perspective, as having one of the most favorable reimbursement environments. Universal coverage, generally streamlined access processes once a drug is approved and funded provincially. It makes it a positive, albeit smaller, market. It's often viewed favorably for health technology assessment processes, too.
Good environment, smaller scale. And the big markets of Europe and the U.S.
Europe offers a very large market overall, but it's heterogeneous, as we've discussed. Access is generally favorable across many countries. Critically, the EASL guidelines provide essential scientific credibility that companies can leverage for regulatory submissions and reimbursement negotiations throughout the region. That balanced ESL approach is often seen as a potential template or benchmark for global development strategies.
So EASL carries a lot of weight there. And the U.S.?
The United States presents a picture of high unmet need, partly because of those significant access barriers around cost and prior authorization that we talked about. But it also offers the potential for premium pricing compared to many other markets. The key to unlocking the U.S. market potential, the sources suggest, is finding ways to successfully address or navigate those access barriers.
So it sounds like a company developing a new CHB drug really has to have a deeply tailored strategy for each major region. They need to understand not just the clinical guidelines, but the whole ecosystem. The healthcare system, the economics, the payers, the regulatory pathways.
Absolutely. It's not a one-size-fits-all market. And the sources strongly suggest that the ESL guidelines, precisely because they are seen as scientifically rigorous, practically minded, and influential across a large number of important countries, are particularly valuable. They can really help shape global clinical development strategies and support international regulatory submissions. Meeting ESL standards often provides a strong foundation for going elsewhere.
Wow. It sounds like navigating these different guideline landscapes is almost as complex as managing the disease itself.
It certainly adds significant layers of complexity, both to providing optimal patient care globally and to bringing innovative new therapies to market.
So as you can see, wrapping this up, this deep dive into chronic hepatitis B guidelines really reveals a fascinating world of variation. It's driven not just by the clinical evidence, which itself evolves, but profoundly shaped by the very different healthcare systems, public health goals, and frankly, economic realities in place around the world.
Yeah, we've really tried to pull out those key nuggets, the dramatic differences in who gets treated and when, how decisions about treatment duration are made, those unique regional approaches to diagnosis in specific groups like pregnant women or the immune tolerant, and of course, the very real practical challenges of getting therapies to the patients who need them, navigating costs and systems across the globe. But what's really fascinating, I think, is how, despite all these wildly different paths described in the sources, some aggressive, some conservative, some focused on systems, some on individual risk ultimately, everyone shares the same fundamental goal: trying to improve outcomes, reduce liver disease progression, prevent cancer, and maybe even strive for a cure for people living with chronic hepatitis B.
Absolutely. Which really raises a final important question for you, our listener, to consider. Given these SART global variations we've discussed, especially that contrast between, say, China's aggressive population-level strategy aiming for elimination and the more conservative individual patient risk-focused approaches common elsewhere, how might future guidelines evolve? How will the global community find a way to balance these ambitious treatment goals, like functional cure or elimination, with the practical realities of implementation, affordability, and crucially, gathering the necessary long-term safety data needed to support potentially treating many millions more people worldwide?